You're listening to a program from the Aloud Archives. Aloud is a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the LA Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud.
I thank you all for coming today. It's a great pleasure for me to be here with Terry Tempest Williams. She certainly has one of the clearest, strongest voices currently resounding through the literature of the American West. A respected essayist and naturalist, Terry's work has been honored with many awards, including a Lannan Foundation Award for Literary Nonfiction, as well as a recent Guggenheim Fellowship. One of the most interesting things, I think, about Terry's work is how she so brilliantly fuses the realms of art, science, and nature. Beginning with her first book, Pieces of White Shell, A Journey to Navajo Land, Coyote's Canyon, Refuge, An Unspoken Hunger, and most recently, Desert Quartet, An Erotic Landscape. I've always admired the deep sensuousness of Terry's writing, both in language and content, and the way that she can open herself, sometimes quite literally, to the experience of nature. Of the last book, Desert Quartet, one critic wrote, "Perhaps no American writer since D.H. Lawrence has so successfully fused the language of desire with that of the natural world." It seems that whenever I attend any sort of gathering of Western writers where the concerns and hopes for our future are discussed, Terry's name inevitably comes up. It comes up because she has had such a singular effect on the way we think about our relationship to nature, and in particular, to the landscape of the West. Terry is not only a very gifted and very sensuous writer, but in some very real sense, she has become a spiritual guide for many writers and readers and contemporary thinkers. She helps us to understand that the future of our world depends on our ability to reawaken an appreciation of the sacred. It was Whitman who long ago complained that unless the material power of America were leavened by some kind of spiritual infusion, we would all wind up among the fabled dam. As we watch species and forests disappear from the earth, and we see our air and our water befouled, there are those who feel that we're approaching that state, and that perhaps the only way out is individuals taking responsibility and saying what they actually feel, and by rekindling a sense of that sacred. This is what Terry does. "Our sojourns into nature are sacred," she has written. "Wilderness courts our souls." She knows the peace of wild things and our essential need to experience such peace. Hers is a very personal relationship to the land. When I read one of Terry's books, I understand what it means to have the capacity to give oneself over completely to the experience of birds and stones, animals and skeletons, feathers, bones, earth, sky, and water. Through her, I also understand the need for ritual, how personal ritual or shared ceremony rooted in landscape provides essential connections and continuity. It reminds us, she says, that we do not stand alone. Rather, we become initiated into something much larger than ourselves, and in doing so, we experience a universal embrace. Not only is her work rooted in the transcendental tradition of Whitman and Emerson, but we find in her essays a deep understanding of the solace that a family can provide, immediate family as well as the larger community. As she wrote in Refuge, "Family gives rise to an energy, a lust for life, A family is not just a mirror, but a clear, still pond, which each of us can gaze into for glimpses of our real being. Refuge is a remarkable book about the power of family and ritual and the sustaining energy and healing powers of the natural world. It chronicles Terry's mother's struggle with breast cancer and her death, as well as the death of her beloved grandmother, Mimi. And it also tells the story of the destruction of the Bear River Bird Refuge in the 1980s, when the waters of the Great Salt Lake rose to such levels that the wetlands were destroyed. A native of Utah, Terry grew up, as I did, living in the shadow of the nuclear test being conducted in the Nevada desert, surrounded by nerve gas and chemical weapon repositories located at the edge of the Great Salt Lake. We were downwinders, children who played beneath skies that occasionally delivered winds laden with nuclear dust. And I think that experience has marked us for life. In Terry's case, it has caused mourning for all the women in her family who have succumbed to breast cancer. But it has also made her love the land and its inhabitants all the more deeply, and to commit herself to their care and their protection. She has been on the forefront as an environmental activist of a number of battles. Her work with the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance helped win the recent designation of the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument in Southern Utah. At a time when there's a real and a very heated debate going on in the West over who controls public lands and how they'll be used, Terry's voice is a conciliatory one. She's a woman able to bridge worlds, someone who can move gracefully and confidently between communities, Mormon communities and Indian tribes, ranchers, environmentalists, businessmen, and politicians. To all of this, she brings an amazing lightness of spirit. And this is the last thing that I'd like to say about Terry's work. There is this quality to her writing of lightness, and to her philosophy itself, that provides such an essential balance to the weighty issues of our time. And it brings to mind an essay in Italo Calvino's last book, Six Memos for the Next Millennium. Calvino intended to deliver these essays as the Charles Norton Lectures in Harvard in 1986. In response to what he called the frantic spectacle of the world. But he died before he was able to deliver these lectures, and they were published posthumously as a book. These six memos for the next millennium are grouped around certain themes: lightness, quickness, exactitude, multiplicity. It's the first essay, Lightness, that caught my attention in relation to Terry's work. In it, Calvino tells a tale from the Decameron, the story of the poet Cavalcante. Cavalcante is wandering through the Italian countryside one day when he comes upon a cemetery. And he's wandering there among the tombs. In fact, he's leaning against a tombstone when a group of riders, ruffians, sort of accost him in the cemetery, and they corner him against the tombstone. And they began taunting him, jeering at him. And at one point, Cavalcante simply looks at his tormentors and says, "You may say anything you wish to me in your home." And with that, with incredible rapidity and agility and lightness, Cavalcante leaps over the tombstone and the wall and makes his escape. I think the point that Calvino was trying to make was that what Cavalcante was saying to his tormentors was, this graveyard, these tombstones, this may be your home, but it's not mine. And then with extraordinary lightness, he makes his escape. This is an auspicious image for the new millennium. The sudden, agile leap of the poet-philosopher who raises himself above the weight of the world, showing that with all his gravity, he has the secret of lightness. That, I believe, is Terry's secret. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm very happy to be able to introduce Terry Tempest Williams.
Thank you, Judith. It's hard to even speak after that. Judith is a sister, so it's a pleasure and a privilege to be able to share this afternoon with her. And it's a gift to be able to share this afternoon with you. Thank you so much for coming to this library to be with us on this beautiful afternoon in Los Angeles on Sunday. I would like to thank Louise at the LA Public Library for bringing us together, this LA County Library. It's such a beautiful building, I had no idea. And also Erica at the Museum of Contemporary Art. It's a wonderful marriage of these two institutions of learning and experience. I would like to dedicate this reading, and it should be around 40 minutes, to a woman I just met upstairs as Louise was showing us the library, the goddess of civilization. Have you seen her upstairs? She's remarkable. She's quite intimidating. And on her head, there's a crown, which is the bear, I assume, of California. And at the base of her staff, holding it steady, is the tortoise. And I would like to begin this reading with a piece about the bear, and I will conclude it with the piece about the tortoise. And in between, I want to read a very short piece that is a landscape trilogy, Clear-Cut, Cutthroat, California. And the last piece, I will ask for your generosity of spirit, because I really just finished it probably 20 minutes before I came here. But I want to share it with you because I've been so moved just since I've been here. And what I can tell you is that I was born in California. I am a Utah native, but I was born here in Riverside County, and I think I've never made peace with that. And so in the spirit of true confession, it came out in the last 24 hours, and I'm sorry that you're going to have to hear this. We'll probably never see the light of day again. But I think it's only fair. You have taken the risk of your time to come, and I want to honor that with a risk of something new. Judith gave me a gift as a sister in Mormon country, and the transformation that she shows me is possible, and the wisdom, and I would like to return this to her. Undressing the bear. He came home from the war and shot a bear. He had been part of the 10th Mountain Division that fought on Mount Belvedere in Italy during World War II. When he returned home to Wyoming, he could hardly wait to get back to the wilderness. It was fall, the hunting season. He would enact the ritual of man against animal once again. A black bear crossed the meadow. The man fixed his scope on the bear and pulled the trigger. The bear screamed. He brought down his rifle and found himself shaking. This had never happened before. He walked over to the warm beast, now dead, and placed his hand on its shoulder. Setting his gun down, he pulled out his buck knife and began skinning the bear that he would pack out on his horse. As he pulled the fur coat away from the muscle, down the breasts and over the swell of the hips, he suddenly stopped. This was not a bear. This was a woman. Another bear story. There is a woman who travels by sled dogs in Alaska. On one of her journeys through the interior, she stopped to visit an old friend, a Koyukon man. They spoke for some time about the old ways of his people. She listened until it was time for her to go. As she was harnessing her dogs, he offered one piece of advice. If you should run into Bear, lift up your parka and show him you are a woman. And another, I have a friend who manages a bookstore. A regular customer dropped by to browse. They began sharing stories, which led to a discussion of dreams. My friend shared hers. I dreamt I was in Yellowstone. A grizzly, upright, was walking toward me. Frightened at first, I began to pull away, when suddenly a mantle of calm came over me. I walked toward the bear, and we embraced. The man across the counter listened, and then said matter-of-factly, "Get over it." Why? Why should we give up the dream of embracing the bear? For me, it has everything to do with undressing, exposing, and embracing the feminine. I see the feminine defined as a reconnection to the self, a commitment to the wildness within, our instincts, our capacity to create and destroy, our hunger for connection as well as sovereignty, interdependence and independence at once. We are taught not to trust our own experience. The feminine teaches us experience is our own way back home, the psychic bridge that spans rational and intuitive waters. To embrace the feminine is to embrace paradox. Paradox preserves mystery, and mystery inspires belief. I believe in the power of bear. The feminine has long been linked to the bear through mythology. The Greek goddess Artemis, whose name means bear, embodies the wisdom of the wild. Christine Downing, in her book, The Goddess: Mythological Images of the Feminine, describes her as, quote, the one who knows each tree by its bark or leaf or fruit, each beast by its footprint or spore, each bird by its plumage or call or nest. It is Artemis, perhaps originally a Cretan goddess of fertility, who denounces the world of patriarchy, demanding chastity from her female attendants. Callisto, having violated her virginity and becoming pregnant, is transformed into the she-bear of the night sky by Artemis. Other mythical accounts credit Artemis herself as Ursa Major, ruler of the heavens and protectress of the pole star, or Axis Mundi. I saw Ursa Major presiding over Dark Canyon in the remote corner of southeastern Utah. She climbed the desert sky as a jeweled bear, following her tracks around the North Star, as she does, year after year, honoring the power of seasonal renewal. At dawn, the sky bear disappeared, and I found myself walking down canyon. 3 years ago, the pilgrimage had been aborted. I fell, head to stone. I rolled down the steep talus slope, stopped only by the grace of an old juniper tree, precariously perched on a 45-degree angle. When I stood up, it was a bloody red landscape. Placing my hand on my forehead, I felt along a 3-inch tear of skin down to the bony plate of my skull. I had opened my third eye. Unknowingly, this is what I had come for. It had been only a few months since the death of my mother. I had been unable to cry. On this day, I did. Now, scarred by experience, I returned to Dark Canyon determined to complete my descent into the heart of the desert. Although I had fears of falling again, a different woman inhabited my body. There had been a deepening of self through time. My mother's death had become part of me. She had always worn a small silver bear fetish around her neck to keep her safe. Before she died, she took off that bear and placed it in my hand. I wore it on this trip. In canyon country, you pick your own path. Walking in wilderness becomes a meditation. I followed a small drainage up one of the benches. Lithic scatter was everywhere, evidence of the Anasazi culture 1,000 years past. I believed the flakes of chert and obsidian would lead me to ruins. I walked intuitively. A smell of cut wood seized me. I looked up. Before me stood a lightning-struck tree, blown apart by the force of the bolt. A fallout of wood chips littered the land in 100-foot radius. The pinyon pine was still smoldering. My companion, who came to the burning tree by way of another route, picked up a piece of the charred wood, sacred to the Hopi, and began carving a bull roar. As he whirled it above our heads on twisted cordage, it wailed in low, deep tones. Rain began, female rain, falling gently, softly, as a fine mist over the desert. Hours later, we made camp. All at once, we heard a roar up canyon, thunder too sustained, jets overhead, a clear sky above. A peculiar organic smell reached us on the wind. We got the message. Flushed with fear, we ran to higher ground. Suddenly, a 10-foot wall of water came storming down the canyon, filling the empty stream bed. If the flood had struck earlier, when we were hiking in the narrows, we would have been swept away like the cottonwood trees it was now carrying. We watched the muddy river as though it were a parade, continually inching back as the water eroded the earth beneath our feet. That night, a lunar rainbow arched over Dark Canyon like a pathway of souls. I had heard the Navajo speak of them for years, never knowing if such magic could exist. It was a sweep of stardust within pastel bands of light, pink, lavender, yellow, and blue. And I felt the presence of angels, even my mother, her wings spread above me like a hovering dove. In these moments, I felt innocent and wild, privy to secrets and gifts exchanged only in nature. I was the tree, split open by change. I was the flood, bursting through grief. I was the rainbow at night, dancing in darkness. Hands on the earth, I closed my eyes and remembered where the source of my power lies. My connection to the natural world is my connection to self, erotic, mysterious, and whole. The next morning, I walked to the edge of the wash, shed my clothes, and bathed in pumpkin-colored water. It was to be one of the last days of autumn. Standing naked in the sand, I noticed bear tracks. Bending down, I gently placed my right hand inside the fresh paw print. Women and Bears. Marian Engel, in her novel Bear, portrays a woman and a bear in an erotics of place. It doesn't matter whether the bear is seen as female or male. The relationship between the two is essential, wild. The woman says, "Bear, take me to the bottom of the ocean with you. Bear, swim with me. Bear, put your arms around me, enclose me. Swim down, 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 down with me. Bear," she says suddenly, "come dance with me." They make love. Afterward, she felt pain, quote, "but it was a clear, dear, sweet pain that belonged not to mental suffering, but to the earth," end quote. I have felt the pain that arises from a recognition of beauty, pain we hold when we remember what we are connected to and the delicacy of our relations. It is this tenderness born out of a connection to place that fuels my writing. Writing becomes an act of compassion toward life, the life we so often refuse to see, because if we look too closely or feel too deeply, there may be no end to our suffering. But words empower us, move us beyond our suffering, and set us free. This is the sorcery of literature. We are healed by our stories. By undressing, exposing, and embracing the bear, we undress, expose, and embrace our authentic selves. Stripped free from society's oughts and shoulds, we emerge as emancipated beings. The bear is free to roam. If we choose to follow the bear, we will be saved from a distractive and domesticated life. The bear becomes our mentor. We must journey out so that we might journey in. The bear mother enters the earth before snowfall and dreams herself through winter, emerging in spring with young by her side. She not only survives the barren months, she gives birth. She is the caretaker of the unseen world. As a writer and a woman with obligations to both family and community, I have tried to adopt this ritual in the balancing of a public and private life. We are at home in the deserts and mountains, as well as in our dens. Above ground, in the abundance of spring and summer, I am available. Below ground, in the deepening of autumn and winter, I am not. I need hibernation in order to create. We are creatures of paradox, women and bears, two animals that are enormously unpredictable, hence our mystery. Perhaps the fear of bears and the fear of women lies in our refusal to be tamed, the impulses we arouse, and the forces we represent. Last spring, our family was in Yellowstone. We were hiking along Pelican Creek, which separated us from an island of lodgepole pines. All at once, a dark form stood in front of the forest on a patch of snow. It was a grizzly, and behind her, two cubs. Suddenly, the sow turned and bolted through the trees. A female elk crashed through the timber to the other side of the clearing, stopped, and swung back toward the bear. Within seconds, the grizzly emerged with an elk calf secure in the grip of her jaws. The sow shook the yearling violently by the nape of its neck, threw it down, clamped her claws on its shoulders, and began tearing the flesh back from the bones with her teeth. The cow elk, only a few feet away, watched the sow devour her calf. She pawed the earth desperately with her front hooves, but the bear was oblivious. Blood dripped from the sow's muzzle. The cubs stood by their mother, who eventually turned the carcass over to them. 2 hours passed. The sow buried the calf for a later meal. She slept on top of the mound with a paw on each cub. It was not until then that the elk crossed the river in retreat. We are capable of harboring both these responses to life in the relentless power of our love. As women connected to the earth, we are nurturing and we are fierce. We are wicked and we are sublime. The full range is ours. We hold the moon in our bellies and fire in our hearts. We bleed, we give milk, we are the mothers of first words. These words grow. They are our children. They are our stories and our poems. By allowing ourselves to undress, expose, and embrace the feminine, we commit our vulnerabilities not to fear, but to courage. The courage that allows us to write on behalf of the earth, on behalf of ourselves. Clear cut. The report from the pathologist reads benign. I do not have breast cancer. This is the fourth biopsy I have had. I am relieved to be healthy, but a melancholy hangs over me. My mother had breast cancer. So did my grandmother's. This story tires me, breaks me down, erodes my spine. It is the sick mantra that never goes away. They are dead. I am alive. I wonder why. Last night, I had a dream. The mountain across from where we live in Immigration Canyon had been clear-cut and domesticated by farms. Green swirls, spirals, patchwork designs became the hillside. I am horrified. My grandmother Letty is sitting on the chaise in our den. I say to her, "How did this happen? And so soon?" She is dressed in white and says nothing. I run outside to see if this is true. My eyes open. The hills beyond our home are still wild. It is only when I look into the mirror that my body reveals the trauma. In another segment of the dream, I am creating a narrative on the forest floor out of found objects, pine needles, sticks and branches, pieces of bark, cones, stones, feathers, moss. It is a sentence written in the native voice of the woods. I do not know what it says, only that I am its scribe. What I feel as I place these letters on the ground is that it is a way to stay the cutting, long flowing sentences rising out of the duff that acknowledge the death of trees. The poet William Merwin's voice returns to me. I want to tell what the forests were like. I will have to speak in a forgotten language. A friend from the forest sends me a large wooden ball. It is made out of yew, yew that heals the cancers of women. Taxol. This is a tree I know from the Willamette Valley. Pacific yew, so elegant below the towering cedars and firs. I remember watching the slash piles burn, the pungent smell that inevitably follows the chainsaws and timber sails. I recall all the clear cuts I have stood in, walked through, in Utah, Idaho, Montana, Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia. The silence, the heat, the mutilations, the stumps, the phantom limbs still waving above my head. The hillside from a distance looked like a woman's body prepped for surgery, shaved and cleared, ready for the scalpel. I hold this U-ball in my hands, close my eyes. What do I see? Heartwood. What do I feel? Wood round like the cyst my body created, now removed by a surgeon. I trust the same surgeon who removed my grandmother's breast, his hands cut and release. What have I released? Another dream fragment flashes before me. Bear tracks in the snow coming down the mountain. They are filled with blood. I see the blood of my mother and grandmother's. I smell the potent sap of you. Slash and burn. Cut and release. I cup my two breasts, one tender, one firm, in my hands. Where did the clear-cut breasts of women go? Where did the trees go? Where has the tissue of my body been thrown? I was unconscious, anesthetized. I should have asked for it back so that I could have buried it in my garden like a sunflower seed. But that is not our option. What is taken from our bodies becomes our pathology, the frozen sections of ourselves placed under a microscope for review. Benign or malignant, we wait for the word. In the meantime, I daydream, make plans. I want to be buried on Antelope Island in Great Salt Lake. It is against the law. But my husband and brothers have promised they will sneak my carapace onto the land, dig a good hole, then cover it with rocks, a fine perch for horned larks. Mormons believe you should be buried with your feet facing east so you can rise in the first resurrection. The first resurrection, quote, is yet future and will take place at the time of the second coming of Christ. The righteous who live after the second coming shall be changed from mortality to immortality in the twinkling of an eye, their bodies and spirits being united inseparably. Mormon Doctrine, 638-39. I want to face west. Toward the lake, toward the setting sun, toward the unknown, my body easing back into earth, food for beetles, worms, and microbes. The songs of meadowlarks and curlews will be my voice. Stampeding bison over my grave is the only eternal vision I need. Collisions with mortality always create death dreams, daydreams, creative detours of the mind that circle our fears and transform them. These moments of acute awareness allow us to claim our deepest desires. I want to live. I want to love. I want more time here, now, on earth. Perhaps this is the gift of illness or biopsies or blood tests or any other momentary pause that allows us to reflect on the delicacy of life, the importance and sustainability of our relations. The final dream is simple. My friend from the forest and I are canoeing in a lake. The mountains that surround us are burning. The trees are burning. When I awaken, my left breast is burning. Merwin's voice echoes again. But what came out of the forest was all part of the story. Whatever died on the way or was named but no longer recognizable, what vanished out of the story, finally day after day, was becoming the story. So that when there is no more story, that will be our story. And when there is no more forest, that will be our forest. What do I do now with the open space in front of my heart? Cutthroat. I once fell in love with a fly fisherman. He was an elegant man, engaged in the justice of rivers. His presence was always toward small streams, tributaries to the Missouri. He dreamed of retiring in Montana. He would walk the creek's willowed edges, halfway hidden, his fly rod in hand with an eye upstream and down for trout. And when he saw the sweet risings of lips to water, he entered the current. This fly fisherman, whose name I cannot speak, would stand thigh-high in the Madison with rod in hand and make the most beautiful undulations, waving his right arm, pulling line with his left, back and forth, the graphite extension of himself would arc above his head seconds before he cast his line of light. Quote, "It is an art that is performed on a four-count rhythm between 10 and 2 o'clock," Norman McLean writes, "in A River Runs Through It. This I saw on the river and recognized as the hours we secretly inhabited. 10 at night until 2 o'clock in the morning. We were awake while others slept." Letting the line gracefully slip through his fingers, he placed the dry fly, I believe it was a royal wolf, perfectly inside the eddy where he imagined the cutthroat to linger. The ritual of the cast, like a tease, was repeated again and again between the man's daydreams, back and forth, back and forth. The trout would strike. The man would smile with a quick flick of his wrist to plant the hook and then slowly reel the creature toward him until it was time to surface the fish. Out of the water, the man would kneel on the bank with the rod between his legs, steady the trout, this time a brook trout with red circles on its side, unhook the fly from its white upper lip. "She feels no pain," he assured me, then return the fish cradled in both hands gently to the water. Let her adjust, get her bearings, face the trout downstream, tickle her belly, and then let her go. Catch and release. Our friendship was no different. It wasn't until he slipped with his tongue and said, "I made love to you because it was the only way I knew how to reel you in. I was afraid I was losing you." Catch and release. This man loves trout. This man loves women. To fish is to flirt. To flirt is to fish. Is this the sporting nature of love? Lips to water, we kiss. We bite the hidden barb, we are pulled out of the river and brought to shore barely breathing. Through the lens of a cutthroat's eye, we look up to what has desired us. That night, I pulled the hook of the dry fly out of my own lip and swam downriver. Catch and release. There is an aspect of love that is not much talked about, the making use of another human being. The lover invariably feels like an object with which the beloved may take liberties. In being loved and desired, we become flesh in the hands of someone else, and so whoever loves me makes possible the miracle of my incarnation. Aldo Caratenuto. In Butte, Montana, Our Lady of the Rockies stands at an elevation of 8,500 feet on the Continental Divide. She is 90 feet tall and weighs 51 tons. Her spine is steel. Draped in the compassionate folds of her white robes, her hands open to the Berkeley pit below, where nearly 1.5 billion tons of earth have been removed, including more than 290 million tons of copper. Anaconda Copper Mining Company has loved Butte, Montana, for almost 100 years. On December 18, 1985, Anaconda pulled out, leaving behind one of America's largest Superfund sites with pit water so toxic, local citizens use firecrackers and flares to keep native birds from landing. On December 20th, 1985, the last piece of Our Lady of the Rockies was brought to the mountain by helicopter and erected by miners now out of work. She was their spark of hope, something new to love, the second largest statue in America, next to Miss Liberty. Call 1-800-800-LADY. Call the cutthroat with scarred lips swimming in the Madison. Call me. Call me home in California. The place where I was born is now a prison. The U.S. Naval Hospital in Riverside County has been closed, transformed into a correctional facility. My father and I stand before chain link fences topped with the horizontal coils of barbed wire. "Keep out," a sign reads. Guards stand their posts. I see that the hospital was huge, part of the March Air Force Base in the 1950s, where the wives of the enlisted gave birth. I imagine the windows without bars, the windows my mother must have looked through during labor, the windows I must have looked through tell stories of Playa Vista and DreamWorks, instantaneous cities of 29,000 residents and 20,000 workers, the possibility of 50,000 people in 1 square mile. We look out over the wetlands, 1,000 acres of open space in Los Angeles, where 589 species of plants and animals thrive, even a chorus of frogs singing in the Sentinella Ditch. A few feet away, a movie set has been erected in the ravages of the salt marsh. China rises in the midst of Marina del Rey. I hear Umberto Eco's voice in his essay Travels in Hyperreality. Quote, "We are not giving you the reproduction so that you will want the original. Rather, we are giving you the reproduction so you will no longer feel any need for the original." DreamWorks. Steven Spielberg, Virtual Reality in Hollywood, Spinning Tales of the Lost World, While the Bayona Wetlands is Still Here, Herons, Egrets, Black-necked Stilts, Dancing the Lost World Back into Existence. The place where I was born is now a prison. This is the last piece. To be taken. The revolutionary question is, what about the other? It is not enough to rail against the descending darkness of barbarity. One can refuse to play the game. A holding action can be fought. Alternatives must be kept alive while learning the slow art of revolutionary patience. Brighton Breitenbach, Tortoise Steps. Tortoise Steps, slow steps, 4 steps like a tank with the tail dragging in the sand, tortoise steps, land-based, land-locked, dusty like the desert tortoise himself, fenced in, a prisoner on his own reservation, teaching us the slow art of revolutionary patience. It is Christmas. We gather in our grandparents' home, aunts, uncles, cousins, babies. 4 generations wipe their feet at the holiday mat. One by one, we open the front door. Hello, we're here. Glass panes, iced, are beginning to melt from the heat of bodies together. Our grandfather Jack, now 90, presides. His sons, John and Richard, walk in dressed in tweed sport coats and Levi's. Their polished boots could kill spiders in corners. My Aunt Ruth enters with her arms full of gifts. Jack's sister, Noreen, in her 80s, sits in the living room with her hands folded tightly, greeting each one of us with a formality we have come to expect. Tradition. On this night, we know a buffet is prepared. Filet mignon, marinated carrots, asparagus, and cauliflower, a cranberry salad, war bread, a recipe our great-grandmother Mamie Comstock Tempest improvised during the Depression when provisions were scarce and raisins plentiful. And the same silver serving piece is obscene with chocolates. The Christmas tree stands in the center of the room, the grandchildren's tree, and we remember our grandmother Mamie, the matriarch of this family, whose last Christmas was in 1988. We remember her. We remember all of our dead. Candles burn. I walk into the dining room, pick up a plate, and circle the table. "What's new, Terrence?" my uncle asks, ribbing me. "Not a thing, Rich," I respond. We both look up from the buffet, smiling. I take some meat with my fingers. He spears vegetables. We return to the living room and find a seat. The rest of the family gathers. Jack sits in the wing-back chair, his hands on both armrests. My father sits across the room from his brother. "So how did the meeting go last week?" "Terrible," Rich says. "What did they decide?" "Simple," my uncle says. "Tortoises are more important than people." Heads turn, attention fixes to matters of the Tempest Company, the family construction business that began with our great-grandfather in the early part of the century, a company my brothers all work for, cousins too. "What are you talking about?" I ask. "Where have you been?" my father asks incredulously. "We've been shut down 18 months because of that." He stops himself, in deference to his aunt, "that stupid Endangered Species Act." I look at my brother Steve, who nods his head, who looks at our cousin Bob, who looks at his sister Lynn, who shakes her head as she turns to my husband Brooke. "I attended the public meeting where they discussed the habitat management plan," Rich says to us. And, Lynn asks, as she walks over to her father and offers him a piece of war bread, they ruled in favor of the tortoise. Which job is this, John? Asks Brooke, who at the time was working for the governor's office of budget and planning as the liaison between environmental groups and the state. It's the last leg of the information highway, Dad says. 7 miles of fiber optic cable running from the town of Hurricane to St. George, linking rural Utah to the Wasatch Front. We're held up in permits, Rich explains. A construction permit won't be issued until U.S. West complies with federal agencies. The government's gone too far, my great aunt interjects. Too far, my father says, his voice rising like water ready to boil. Too far. We've had to hire a full-time biologist at $60 an hour who does nothing but look for these imaginary animals. Every day he circles the crew singing the same song. Nope, haven't seen one yet. The guy's from Brigham Young University and sits in the cab of his truck most of the day reading scripture, adds Steve, who is the superintendent. Thou shalt not kill a turtle, someone mutters under their breath. $60 an hour, Dad reiterates. That's twice as much as our foremen make. It would be cheaper to buy a poolside condominium for each mating pair of tortoises than to adhere to the cost of this ridiculous act. The government's gone too far, my aunt restates, like a delayed echo. And on top of that, we have to conduct a turtle training course. Tortoise John, his granddaughter Callie interrupts. I wink at my niece. A turtle training course for our men so they can learn to identify one and then remember to check under the tires and skids for tortoises looking for shade before turning on the backhoes after lunch. Our men. Rich stands up to get more food. $100,000 if we run over one, he says, making himself a sandwich. Is that worth the expense? To the turtle, says my cousin Lynn. What's St. George now, the fourth fastest growing community in the country, Brooke asks. What do you kids want, Rich says, to stop progress? You and your environmentalist friends have lost all credibility. One local told us a bunch of radicals actually planted a tortoise in the parking lot of the Walmart distribution center just to shut it down. How do you know it didn't walk onto the asphalt by itself, I ask. They had its stomach pumped, and it was full of lettuce, my uncle replies. Steve asked his cousin Matt, who is a first-year medical student, have you performed an autopsy on a desert tortoise yet? Not yet, Matt responds. Just human beings. Can I get anyone anything? Ruth asks, holding her granddaughter Hannah on her hip. She looks around. No response. Just checking. And you wonder why people are upset, my father says, turning to me. It's easy for you to sit here and tell us what animals we should protect while you write poems about them as a hobby. It's not your pocketbook that's hurting. And is yours? I ask, fearing I have now gone as far as my father has. I was not aware of the background music until now. Nat King Cole singing, Have a Merry, Merry Christmas. I don't know, Jack says, clearing his throat and pulling himself up out of his chair. Why don't you boys tell him the real story? John and Richard look puzzled. What story? Rich asks. Hard Pan, Jack says. Never mind, my father says, grinning. Just keep that one quiet. Richard starts giggling like a little boy. Tell, we beg our grandfather. He placed his hands on the back of the lounge. We had 22 crews during the war, put all the piping in the air bases at Tooele, Salt Lake, Hill, and Ogden. I never went to bed for 5 years. 1941, 42, 43, 44, 45, just dropped dead on this lounge from exhaustion every night. We even had work in Las Vegas, putting a big water line to the north. I was away for weeks, missing Catherine and the boys. And then one day, I was walking along the trench when I spotted what I thought was a helmet. I bent down, it moved. I realized it was a tortoise. I picked it up, its head and feet shot back into its shell. I put him in the back of my truck and brought him home for the boys. We named him Hard Pan. He looks at his sons, smiles, and walks out of the room. Everybody else had a dog, my father says. German Shepherds, Doberman Pinschers, Black Labs. We drilled a hole in his shell and tied a long cord to it and walked him around the block. We all look at each other. No kidding, Rich says. Every day we walked him. Hard Pan, I ask. You know, the desert without rain. Hard Pan, no give to the sand. My father's voice is now tender. He was reliable, old Hard Pan. You have to say that about him, Rich adds. Until he disappeared, Jack says, returning to his chair. Gopherus agazazi, desert tortoise, land turtle, an elder among us, even among my family. For some of us, he represents landlocked, like the wilderness before us. Designate wilderness, and development is locked out. Find a tortoise, and another invisible fence is erected. The tortoise's presence compromises our own. He is an obstruction. For others, the tortoise is land-based, a sovereign on earth, an extension of family, human and non-human alike, living in arid country. His presence enhances our own. The tension the tortoise inspires calls for wisdom. These animals may live beyond 100 years. They walk for miles, largely unnoticed, carrying a stillness with them. 15 acres may be home range, and they know it well. When they feel in their bodies that it is about to rain, they travel to where water pools. They wait, clouds gather, skies darken, it rains. They drink, it may be days, weeks, months before their beaks touch water again. If native mythologies are true, and turtles carry the world on their backs, the carapace of the desert tortoise is designed to bear the weight. It is a landscape with its own aesthetic. Three scutes or plates run down the vertebrae, hexagons with two larger scutes on top and bottom. Four plates line either side of center. The shell is bordered by 24 smaller ones that seem to hold the animal in place. The plastron, or bottom of the shell, fits together like a 12-tiled floor. The desert tortoise lives inside his own creation, like a philosopher who is most at home in his mind. In winter, the desert tortoise hibernates, but not in the manner of bears. Hibernation for reptiles is brumation, a time of dormancy where cold-blooded creatures retire rock still, with physiological changes occurring independent of their body temperatures. Much remains mysterious about this type of seasonal retreat, but brumation among turtles suggests it is sparked by conditions of temperature, moisture, photoperiod, and food supply. They stir in their stone-ledged dens when temperature rise, dens they inhabit year after year, one, two, maybe five individuals together. They leave, they forage, they mate. The female lays eggs in supple sands. Two dozen eggs may be dropped in a nest, buried, incubated, hatched, and then the quiet plodding of another generation of desert tortoises meets the sands. It is a genealogy of evolutionary adaptation, until Gophers agazazi suddenly begins bumping into real estate developers after having the desert to himself for millenniums. 1996, a lone desert tortoise stands before a bulldozer in the Mojave. My father and the Endangered Species Act. My father, as an endangered species, the Marlboro man without his cigarette is home on the range. I will list him as threatened by his own vulnerable nature. I will list him as threatened by my emotional nature. Who dares to write the recovery plan that regulates our own constructions? He will resist me. I will resist him. He is my father. I am his daughter. He holds my birth story. I will mourn his death. We face each other. Hand over our hearts. In the American West, United States do not exist even within our own families. Don't tread on me. The snake coils, the tortoise retreats. When the dust devil clears, who remains? My father, myself, threatened species. I recall a statement made to me by another elder, a Mormon general authority who feared we had chosen not to have children. Call it Ode to the Gene Pool. A manipulation of theology, personalized, tailorized to move me toward motherhood, another bulge in the population. Quote, a female bird, he wrote to me, has no options as to whether she will lay eggs or not. She must, God insists, because if she does not, a precious combination will be lost forever. One of your deepest concerns rests with endangered species. If a species dies out, its gene pool will be lost forever, and we are all the lesser because of that loss. The eggs you possess, over which your husband presides, are precious genes. You are an endangered family. End quote. I resist. Who will follow? Must someone follow? Clouds gather. It rains. The desert tortoise drinks where water has pooled. Who holds the wisdom? My grandfather, the tortoise, calls for the story and then disappears. Tortoise steps, tortoise tracks, tracks in time. One can refuse to play the game. Across from where I sit is a red rock ledge. We are only a stone's toss away from the city of St. George. I am hiking with my father. He has gone on ahead. Today is the spring equinox, equal light, equal dark, a day of truce. I have followed tortoise tracks to this place, a den. It is cold. The air stings my face. I did not dress warmly enough. Once again, the desert deceives as wind snaps over the ridge and rides down valley. The tortoise is inside. I wish to speak to him, to her, to them, about my tribe of people, my family, my tribe of people who lose money and make money without recognizing their own threatened status. My tribe of people who keep tortoises, turtles, as pets and wonder why they walk away. I pull a clipping from the local paper out of my pocket, unfold it, and read it out loud. If you're a desert tortoise living in Washington County, take this advice. Start crawling your way toward the hills north of St. George, Utah. Come March 15th, any tortoise living outside a specially designated desert tortoise reserve could become subject to taking, a biological term for the death of an animal or the destruction of its habitat. State and federal officials on Friday signed an interlocal agreement that will set aside 61,000 acres of prime tortoise habitat as a reserve that wildlife biologists believe will secure the reptile's recovery. On the flip side, the agreement also provides permission and means by which developers may take some 1,200 tortoises and develop more than 12,000 acres of tortoise habitat outside the reserve without violating the Endangered Species Act, under which the tortoise is listed as a threatened species. Friday's signing and 6 years of battles over the slow-moving animal whose presence around St. George has created headaches for land developers and local governments. We feel confident that we're going to be able to work together, says Bob Williams, assistant supervisor for the Fish and Wildlife Service. Between 1980 and 1990, Washington County's population increased 86% from 26,125 to 48,560. It is projected to have between 101,000 and 139,000 people by 2010. Implementation of the Habitat Conservation Plan is scheduled to last 20 years and cost $11.5 million, unquote. There is no movement inside the den. Tortoise, I have two questions for you from Neruda. ¿Quién de los nombres y los números al inocente innumerable? Who assigns names and numbers to the innumerable innocent? Come lo digo a la tortuga que yo le gano en lentitude? How do I tell the turtle that I am slower than he? The desert tortoise is still. I suspect he hears my voice simply for what it is, human. The news and questions I deliver are returned to me and somehow dissipate in the silence. It is enough to breathe, hear, together. Our shadows lengthen while the white petaled heart of Datura opens and closes. We have forgotten the option of restraint. It is no longer the survival of the fittest, but the survival of compassion. Inside the red rock ledge, the emotional endurance of the tortoise stares back at me. I blink. To take. To be taken. To die. The desert tortoise presses me on the sand, down on all fours. The shell I now find myself inhabiting is a keratinous room where my spine is attached to its ceiling. Head, hands, feet, and tail push through six doors and search for a way home. Tortoise steps. Land-based, landlocked. Land-based, landlocked. Learning. The slow art of revolutionary patience. I listen to my family.
wonderful readings.
Terry and I don't often have a chance to actually be together and to just talk about things, and it was a very wonderful thing to be able to be here today and to listen to those stories. I guess I was really interested in the fact that you visited the little wetlands yesterday, and particularly since that area is where a new movie studio was being built. And one of the things that I had brought with me, I don't know whether you saw this or not, but in last Sunday's New York Times, I was looking through the arts and leisure section, and I came across this piece, which to me was quite remarkable, with the headline, "Motherly, Not Her, Nature is Trying to Kill You." And it's an entire article on the movie industry and the number of movies that are coming out right now that really portray nature as the new villain. In other words, movies like Volcano and Twister and Anaconda, movies about giant waves and asteroids and diseases loosed from the jungle. And I know, I'm curious about this. I had come across this article just after reading a sentence from one of your books in which you said, "We are a nation suspicious of nature." What do you make of all of this?
I think it's fascinating that, first of all, and again, it's feminine. I did read that article, and the way it said, the new enemy. I loved the new enemy. I mean, there were all sorts of language twists and turns. The new enemy, Mother Nature. So again, it's the feminine. Again, it's nature. And again, mm-hmm. we think that the land forces, earth forces, are something new.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's interesting. Obviously, it must be making money, or they right. wouldn't be doing it.
Right.
And juxtaposed that, I thought it was fascinating that with North Dakota, mm-hmm. where maybe you saw this, where they are now blaming the weather forecasters. It's not the river, you know, it's not cycles, but it's the weather forecasters who blew it and didn't reveal secret information that it was mm-hmm. going to go up another few inches. Mm-hmm. It reminds me of in Salt Lake City when Great Salt Lake was rising. Mm-hmm. I remember there was a developer named Wally Wright, and I called and asked if I could meet with him, and he said, "I'll meet you at Papa Murphy's in the back corner. I'll be wearing a white trench coat." And I walked in, and sure enough, you could see him, you know, the smoke rising, and he said, "They told me it wouldn't rise." And I said, "Really, who?" And the Utah legislature had said that it was against the law for Great Salt Lake to go to rise beyond 4206. And so nature as outlaw, nature as enemy, nature above the law.
Obviously, Mother is not, she's not obeying her...
Have you seen Volcano?
No, I haven't.
Has anyone seen Volcano?
Apparently, it just came out this weekend. But one of the remarkable things about it is in this article, someone was quoted as saying, "With a force of nature and a computer, you can be as evil as you want." And I suppose the computer really helps to enhance this idea of nature as villain. Nature is the new evil.
And the irony, I mean, it was so amazing going out with Bruce Robertson and Marcia Hanscom with the Biona Valley Preservation League and the Wetlands Action Network. I so appreciate what they're doing. And the irony of here we were seeing this last vein of wetlands, and just not only the ecological relief, but the visual relief in this
right.
Biona Valley, this Los Angeles, and then to see this set of China, you know, to see the buildup of Marina Del Rey, to see the, 100 plus, maybe 200 acres designated wetlands, and then all of this other, and to hear that this is Spielberg and Geffen, you know, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera's idea of a great sound stage,
mm-hmm.
it is virtual reality with mm-hmm. the real world. And I was interested he has a film coming out called The Lost World. And here in the production of those kinds of images, we are losing the real world.
Mm. I wonder, I mean, I know that the more anxious we get, the more that we need fables and fairy tales, stories in which
the worst possible things can happen. But it's interesting that nature has become that force of evil. It's no longer the wolf, and it's no longer the bear, it's no longer animals, it's no longer communists, it's no longer all sorts of villains, but it's now nature. And I wonder if it has anything to do with the fact that we have created a kind of mentality that we are at war with nature. We have assaulted nature, and we realize that we have done that. We have disregarded her, and we have abused her. And I wonder if part of the mentality, in a very perhaps subconscious way, has to do with creating that nature coming back at us with a vengeance.
I think so. I think it's also the fact that we cannot control these forces. Mm. And so maybe we can control it through our imagination, or again, it's the large myth we take into the next millennium. And I think, have we really evolved? You know, when you read the Bible, it was pestilence, it was earthquakes, it was floods, and now my uncle, you know, just said, we are counting down to the last days. I mean, he is ready, facing east, you know, for the second coming, and maybe it is coming. Mm-hmm. But I think that this idea of millennialism, it may strike this archetypal fear or terror in our moment of marking time, that all this is coming through. And I thought, even with all of our technology, you know, Volcano, Twister, just as you say, can you believe Anaconda?
Giant snake.
And then people say, I was talking to a friend today, and she said, well, you know, people say, I just want to go for the special effects. And what does that mean? My little nephew wants to be a Twister chaser. That's all he dreams of now. Uh-huh. And he looks at the weather forecast. His mother is just heartbroken, you know, thinking, what are we creating?
That is a sort of, you know, warped view of nature, and a kind of mythology to be putting out there. But undoubtedly, it probably is connected to the millennium. I've been thinking about this series, and every time I think of it, instead of thinking of racing toward the millennium, somehow I kept thinking of slouching toward Bethlehem. And I know they're quite different things, but in fact, we really aren't, it doesn't seem to me, slouching at all toward the millennium, but that we are now racing, that we've come into the fast water, and we can sort of hear the noise around the corner. We know that it's coming, and that it will have a kind of impact. And even if we're not among those like your uncle who are sort of, you know, awaiting the arrival in some larger sense, it will have an impact. It does have an impact on our consciousness.
The mass suicide we've just experienced. And when you look at the cultural stories, just on the front page, it's fascinating. I think it's so instructive. I mean, here is a group of people that called their bodies containers, that were seeking a better life. What does that mean? When we experience the world through our bodies. And I was thinking, you know, here on one page of the paper, I was reading about, again, the floods with the Red River in North Dakota, and how they lost their history. Their history was burned in the newspaper building. It had their birth certificates, their death certificates, all their stories. So now the history of that town is now oral, dependent upon each other's voices. Right across the page was another story of a group of people who were reconstructing their histories, reconstructing their stories, the Mormons who are now going back through their pilgrimage into Zion. And this sense of history, this sense of body, this sense of destiny, even Hale Bopp, you know, the signature of light over our heads.
And certainly our stories and the stories that we tell ourselves in order to shape our lives. And sometimes they really aren't stories so much about who we are as who we want to be. What Terry's referring to is that it's been 150 years since the Mormons made the trek from winter quarters in Missouri across the plains to Salt Lake City. And so there are a group of people who are enacting that trek. We share this history, which I don't share with many other people who are not quite in the same way. I was interested when I was in Salt Lake City last weekend to see that there was a NOW convention, National Organization of Women, being held in Salt Lake. And one of the keynote speakers was a polygamous wife who was talking about really defending polygamy as a sort of feminist position. And her attitude was, look, here we are, 8 women, and we only need 1 man. That must be a feminist position.
And I loved this is where we come from.
Wow.
And then further on down, I think she said, you know, actually, the men are irrelevant. Then it really got interesting. That was on the back page.
Well, this is sort of related to that, but your books really do celebrate the idea of the earth goddess and the feminine and the need, as I said earlier in my introduction, to reinfuse our lives with a sense of the sacred, especially given the materialism of this culture. Earth goddesses have always had a role to play. I think even in our religion, which is a very patriarchal culture, where women are told that their access to God really comes through men, through the priesthood that men hold. But we know that women have always found a way to have their own priestesshood in spite of whatever kind of patriarchal culture they live in. I guess my question for you is, you've joined a tradition of Western writers, naturalists, essayists, people are really concerned in writing about nature, from Ed Abbey to Barry Lopez to that wild man Doug Peacock, who I just met, who studies grizzly bears and is an extraordinary person. Do they have a totally different sensibility to offer us at this time in history about nature than women do? Or do you see a fusing of the male sensibility and the female sensibility in nature writing, period?
It's a good question. And I don't know. I think about the texts. If we look at, first of all, I think it's an American tradition. I don't think it's a recent one. I mean, I think if we look at Melville with Moby Dick, I think if we look at Emily Dickinson in her poems, her exhortations of beauty, when we think of Mary Austin writing about the California desert in The Land of Little Rain, we can move all the way up with, I think, Faulkner with the bear, Hemingway, Old Man in the Sea, Steinbeck, certainly Cannery Row, and the beautiful Log to the Sea of Cortez. I think this is in our tradition of American letters. Rachel Carson, Silent Spring, so on to the contemporary writers that you mention. Is there a female voice? Is there a male voice? I think when you look at the male texts, many of them tend to be journeys away from home, almost like the hero's journey that Campbell talks about. Mm. Leaving home, going to find the gold, so to speak, and coming back and revealing that to the community. I think many of the women's texts, you look at Linda Hogan, I think your stories, it's much more concerned about where we live here and now, how we create community with the ground beneath our feet. That may be a different sensibility. I do think there is a feminine, and again, the language does not serve us, and I don't know how to talk about that, but I think there is a language of interconnectedness that binds all of these narratives that I think is what's so important.
It brings to mind a quote from D.H. Lawrence, and Lawrence, you know, who was extraordinarily passionate. He was one of the first writers who really affected me. And yes, he can be excessive on the subject of men and women, but in a quite wonderful way. Mm. And I remember reading somewhere that he once said that the future of the world really will not be determined between nations or races, but that it will be played out in the struggle for power between men and women. Mm. So I think it's a very real concern for us as we approach the millennium. It's certainly something that hasn't been resolved in the recent decades of feminism or the feminist movement. We still see a kind of different sensibility. I see that in young people, even in college classes. But it seems like that's an arena, that area. I still turn on the TV and I see rooms full of men making decisions. So That,
and I think about issues of power. I mean, again, I can't get out of my mind the Bayona wetlands, mm-hmm. and that is an issue of power, and who carries the voice? Who are we allowing to be heard in the culture? Mm-hmm. Developers, you know, is it Buena Vista or Playa Vista, DreamWorks, or a small group of local citizens who are saying, can't we use restraint? Can't we exercise our own sovereignty as members of this valley and say, this is, we want to reimagine the landscape? I mean, just even that pilgrimage they did on Earth Day, I thought was so moving, from the headwaters of the LA River, to remember there is an LA River.
Right.
And that there were people before us. And I think even deeper than that, to redefine our notion of community, to include all life forms, plants, animals, rocks, rivers, and human beings, so that there is a community of great evolutionary standing in those wetlands that, given half a chance, will not only thrive but flourish. Mm-hmm. I think these are the questions of justice, of power, that in my mind transcend gender, mm-hmm. although I think its root is in gender discrimination.
Right, and
to beyond species, really.
And its root may lie in more in the feminine consciousness.
Exactly.
In each of us, male or female, as opposed to another kind of consciousness. Although, again, those labels are beginning to wear out. It's as though we need to think more deeply about language and how we want to use it in terms of gender in the future.
I think about the power of passion. And again, the stories that you hear when you come into a new community, the woman and... her name is Flossie. Florence, is she here? Tell me your last name.
Oh, Morgan.
I just appreciate so much what you have done for the Bolsa Chica. One woman who is saying to her community, we can join forces against a so-called done deal. Those are the stories that I hear in every community in this country, and they give me enormous hope. Mm. I do think they're rooted in the feminine. I do think that they're rooted in love, and I do think that that transcends power in a very deep way.
Mm. I love the way that in Refuge, finally the final refuge that you name is the refuge of love. And it seems like that's a sensibility, a loving kindness toward the land, towards its inhabitants, toward one another as we head toward the millennium.
And that we can be both fierce and compassionate at once. Mm. I remember meeting a woman named Chandra Laka, who lives in India. She was a colleague of Gandhi's. And she said, it is about indignation, sacred rage, that when you sit, you feel that spine, our spine, connecting all the way to the core of Earth. And that's what gives us our resolve, to stand in the face of seemingly hopeless situations. And that's what I find in the literature that moves me. That's what I find in community actions that move me. I think it's seeing the world whole, even holy, knowing when there is a time to speak, knowing that when there is a time for silence.
This is changing the subject, but it's a question that I really want to ask, because I know that in Salt Lake, the first incinerator has been built to destroy, to try and get rid of, the large arsenal of chemical weapons and nerve gas. I know that it made many people in Utah very, very nervous, the thought that this incinerator would be built, and it does seem like it's something of an experiment. And for many of us, we're wondering, how's it working?
In the West Desert.
Yeah, is it a viable way to get rid of this stuff that we've created that now that we're saddled with it?
It's endless. I actually, there's an incredible photographer, Emmett Gowan, mm-hmm. maybe you know his work, mm-hmm. where he is taking images, aerial images of landscapes we cannot see from the ground, from our standing. And from the Nevada test site to Hanford, to the Salton Sea, to the West Desert in Tooele. And my husband, Brooke, and I flew over with him. It was devastating. I've lived in Utah all of my life, except for the 2 years I spoke of today, and I had no idea of the pocking, the scarring, the toxic pools. And you could see with the SALT II agreement the explosions that look like craters, literally, on the moon. Is it working? I don't know. Mm-hmm. We have to trust them. The biological... the chemicals that are being produced there. I'm so relieved last week that the chemical ban treaty was signed. Mm-hmm. I was noticing, here I just got some information, Americans for a Safe Future, about what's going on in the Ward Valley, again, in Southern California, and the kind of vigilance that is being maintained here. I think those are role models for what we need to do as citizens. Mm-hmm. I worry with Yucca Flats. Again, 2 weeks ago, that was another bill signed where all of America's nuclear waste will go to Yucca Mountain. What does that mean for America's highways when we're moving? And I don't know what the answers are.
It's very hard to say we have to trust them, but in a way we do have to trust them because it's also a problem of information. We have in the past, we've known that we haven't gotten the correct information.
So how do we trust them?
It's kind of a terrifying situation.
And I think, again, that is the power of a pen, whether it's a letter to the editor, that is the power of personal involvement, local communities standing up. I was rereading Wallace Stegner's Gathering of Zion. I don't know if you've read that recently.
No,
there was a word that I came across that I didn't know what it means. Hegira? Do you know that word? Do you know that word?
No.
I looked it up because he talked about it over and over again. And what it means is departure from one's country and friends. Mm. Hegira. And I thought about the mass exodus that at least those of us in Utah are perceiving is happening in California. Mm-hmm. I think I bring that up. I really want to encourage staying. But I think it's the same with nuclear waste. Owning our land, viscerally, intellectually, emotionally, spiritually, even the most ravaged parts of our landscape, and that idea of restoration, restoration of Biona, restoration of our own souls. There's, again, no separation. I love the idea of the nuclear guardianship program, that the nuclear waste stays where it is produced and citizens within that community are on a constant rotation of guarding that site. So the story is told for 10,000 years. Somehow we cannot keep hiding, burying, dumping, disguising,
denying
what our role in the degradation of the earth is. And we're all complicit.
And in a funny way, it ties in with the conference on volunteerism that's occurring this weekend. And I think that's a very legitimate and important concept, that we really can't expect government any longer to take care of everything. Our communities have dissolved. Our families often are, members are far flung. And so perhaps the idea is that we really have to either strive to build more stable communities, to stay where we are, to take care of what's in our own backyard, to care more deeply on a smaller scale for our own landscape and families.
You know, issues of power and that word, our own backyard. I remember being in Washington, D.C., and maybe you saw this. It was a full-page ad that says, not in my backyard. And it went on to call, 1-800-da-da-da-da-da. And I actually called the number. And I said, excuse me, that is my backyard you're talking about. It said, what was it? I actually wrote it down because you have to get the exact wording. It's so unbelievable. Oh, where was it? I don't know, maybe I didn't. But it just said, not in my backyard, send it away to some remote foreign desert in the West.
Idaho.
Right.
Nevada.
Right, Utah.
Utah.
And so I called up and I said, excuse me, I was reading, just drinking a little cup of coffee, and I noticed you said, not in my backyard, put it in their backyard. And I said, that is my backyard. And she goes, excuse me, let me transfer your call. Bing. And then I got the information officer, and I said, not in my backyard, not in your backyard. That is my backyard. It's Utah, it's Wyoming, it's Idaho, it's et cetera, et cetera. And he said, I'm so sorry. You weren't supposed to see that. That is about power.
Yeah.
And that idea that we in the American West, California may be a little different, but we're still in the West, are a low-use segment of the population. Mm. What do we do about that? I was interested in reading Bill Kittredge's book, Who Owns the West? It's a wonderful book if you haven't read it. Two paragraphs. We know the story of civilization. It can be understood as a history of conquest, law-bringing, and violence. We need a new story, which is what you're saying. in which we learn to value intimacy. Somebody should give us a history of compassion, which would become a history of forgiveness and caretaking. Hmm.
That makes me think of a theologian I was talking to recently who said that he wants to teach a class that would combine religion and environmentalism, because he really, we understand that we are leaving for future generations a earth with so many problems, a greater concept of selflessness that will help us think more of future generations. We will, in fact, leave an environmentally devastated earth for the future. How can we cultivate that concept of selflessness? Does it require a reemergence of the sacred, of the spiritual, of religion, of something? I mean, I think that's what he was saying, and I think maybe we would agree on that. However you define that, that concept of the sacred and has to be reintroduced into how we think of the land, how we approach it, and how we use it.
Mm. And just those small gestures, they're never large.
Right.
But the small dailiness of our lives, the practices of the wild. Mm. I mean, this morning, I just was so moved by that Lise Tern sanctuary. I mean, literally, it is a postage stamp, that enclosure. And yet, as we were saying, given half a chance, they not only flourish but thrive. I mean, there they were everywhere, trying to nest, feeding, bringing back the fish. And, I mean, it seemed the size of this auditorium, that the internal spaces in Los Angeles are larger than the space we've designated for that Lise Tern. Mm. What does that mean? I think, what would the impact be if every citizen in Los Angeles were to sit and contemplate those terns 15 feet back from the fence so they don't disturb them.
Right.
But I think about those kinds of things.
And the need for ritual. I could go on talking and talking with you for a long time, but I feel that our time is coming to an end, and maybe there are a few questions from the audience. We probably would have time for two or three if anyone does have a question for Terry.
Staircase Escalante, and you talk about building communities. What's the way that, as Westerners and people all over this country, can start developing and implementing plans to bring about communities like Kanab and the communities in Kane County that right now they're disagreeing with you and they just feel like you're taking away their sense of communities? You know, I agree with you, but I think we need to find a plan that we can implement, you know, instead of just describing. I mean, you're kind of preaching to the choir here. How do we implement these plans with those people who need the community and feel that by producing wilderness, we're taking it away?
It's a complicated question. The question is regarding, you know, at least I'm interpreting it, how do I live in my own community when I've really contributed to the polarity within my state, which is at a spiritual war? And I really, it hurts me to even use that kind of language regarding the Utah wilderness issue, and specifically the new Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. I'll try and make this quick, but it's complicated. I have really tried to work in a manner of consensus regarding wilderness in Utah. And we were working in a very slow process called Project 2000, where we were trying to bring various people to sit around the table and discuss these ideals. I can't tell you the committees I've been on, whether it was Integral Vistas with the National Parks or Utah Wilderness. It's slow going. Talk about revolutionary patience. But we were making progress because it's always about relationships to each other, listening, and then being able to implement those. And I don't think it's so much about compromise as composition and imagination. And we're not so far as we seem. Then what happened in the state of Utah? We had the elections in 1994, and suddenly in Utah we had total Republican sweep along with the rest of the country, and they decided, along with our governor, that on January 4th they would state, we will have a wilderness bill in Utah. And to the governor's credit, he said, but not without a public process. We engaged in that six-month public process, hearings, testimonies, letters, And what we found out was that over 70% of those residents in Utah wanted more wilderness, not less. When the bill came out, the Utah Public Lands Management Act of 1995, and designated 1.8 million acres out of 22 million acres, we knew that that process was a sham, justice had not been served, and that the interests of the extractive industries had been maintained. And I felt personally that my family was under siege. And I believed enough in the democratic process that we had to stand our ground in the landscape we loved. One quick story. The citizens had their own hearing where we had we were on open time, and the native community in Salt Lake let us use the Indian Walk-In Center, and we were there till 3 in the morning. We had representatives that then testified before Congress. I was fortunate enough to be one of those to represent citizens' voices. As I gave my testimony to the House Subcommittee on Natural Resources, which they have since taken the word natural out, I sat in front of my congressman, Jim Hansen, and was reading the various testimonies of the citizens. And I noticed he was flipping through pages, he was, you know, yawning, he was reading, and I finally stopped, broke away from the text, and I said, "Congressman Hansen, I am a woman, I have lived in Utah all of my life. Is there anything I can say to you that in any way will open up this line of discussion, that will open up your heart to view these lines in another way?" And he said, "Excuse me, Miss Williams, there is something about your voice I cannot hear." And that became such a metaphor for me in terms of what we were up against. I think there was a public outcry nationally, and I think Congress responded. It never met, it never went to the floor of the House. It never, when it got to the Senate, it was stopped in a filibuster led by Senator Bradley of New Jersey, who said, "I would like, these are national lands, these are public lands belonging to all Americans, and I would like to read from one of my constituents." And then you hear the words, and you can read them in the congressional record, "Basin Range, Basin Range, Basin Range," from John McPhee. I think that the monument was a result of that national outcry, and I am so grateful to the democratic process and the 1906 Antiquities Act that allowed a president to enact that. Very quickly, my husband Brooke is working with the local communities, trying to create sustainable economies that are not in conflict with wilderness values, but are in fact compatible. Value-added timber, the creation of land trusts so that farming and ranching still can be maintained, and we don't have these second, third, fourth, and fifth homes coming in that don't create the vitality of a community. So, and the last thing I would say is, I don't think that the disparity and the bitterness is as great as the media would have us to believe. And I think it's really important for us to understand that, because they would have, and when I say they, who is they? Is it corporate powers? Is it our politicians? Or is it the media desperate for a story that's simple? It's much more complex than that. And I think what we always have to know is we have to face each other as citizens. And we're not as far as the papers would lead us to believe, or as the politicians would want us to believe. And so I think we roll up our sleeves, and I would predict that 2 years from now, 5 years from now, 50 years from now, we will be so grateful for those open spaces. Thank you very much. Thank you, Terry.
I think that's a wonderful place to end our conversation. Thank you all very much for coming. Thank you, Terry, for being here.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.